From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, likely new leader on bringing order and peace to Ukraine. Cameroon and Chad deploying troops to fight Boko Haram. Pope ends a delicate Mideast trip with call for peace, plus the case of racist comments by a U.S. sports team owner. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Petro Poroshenko took the majority of votes in Ukraine's Sunday presidential election. And on Monday, he said there will be no talks with terrorists, his word for the armed pro-Russian separatists in the eastern part of the country. Mr. Poroshenko said Monday that peace can be reached through a dialogue, including with Russia.
Russia is our biggest neighbor. And because of the fact that stopping the war and bringing the peace to the whole Ukraine and bringing stability on the eastern part of Ukraine, that would be impossible without participation of Russian representative.
A Ukrainian rebel leader in Donetsk said he also is ready to talk with Poroshenko, but only if the talks concern a prisoner swap and pulling Ukrainian forces out of the east. We go to Kiev now, and Jamie Detmer, who reports European observers are saying Sunday's presidential election in Ukraine largely met international standards.
It was one of the largest election observation teams European authorities have assembled to monitor an election. More than 1,000 observers were fielded by the Organization for European Security and Cooperation, or OSCE. And the head of the mission, Joao Soares, along with European parliamentarians, gave his verdict.
As you have heard, the international observers recognize these elections as proper and decent.
The Portuguese politician decried the sabotage of the elections by separatists in Ukraine's two easternmost provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk, where pro-Russian insurgents managed to stop any voting in 24 out of 34 polling districts. But he insisted that the outcome of the vote should be respected, noting that the turnout of 60% across the country was higher than the turnout for Sunday's European parliamentary polls in 27 countries.
Of course, there were problems in Donetsk and in Luhansk, but the turnout in all Ukraine is much better than the turnout of the same elections that occurred in the same day to the European Parliament. I am a member of the European Union. I've been in the European Parliament. I would be very proud to have this turnout in my own elections.
It remains unclear still how many Easterners did manage to vote. One estimate on Sunday by Ukraine's election commission put the turnout at 9% in Donetsk, where separatists abducted election officials, threatened poll workers, and forced the closure of polling stations. The OSCE, the main outside group monitoring Sunday's presidential race, said the election was characterized by high turnout and the clear resolve of authorities to hold what was a genuine election, largely in line with international commitments and with respect for fundamental freedoms. The OSCE report also says voting and counting procedures were transparent and that candidates were able to campaign freely. It notes that at 98% of polling stations observed outside eastern Ukraine, voting was orderly and well organised. But the OSCE says that the early tabulation of the vote was at times chaotic, partly because of a virus buried by separatists in the Election Commission's computer system. For all of the problems in the East, European parliamentarians said the fact that billionaire Petro Poroshenko won on an outright victory in the first round of voting, doing away with the need for a June runoff, illustrates the legitimacy of his election, proving that he is backed by most of the country. Swiss politician Andreas Gross says the separatists failed to undermine the vote's legitimacy.
You know, legitimacy is a product of an election which is a nationwide effort, and you can't hinder in two provinces some people not to go to vote with the hope that you can undermine the legitimacy of the outcome of a national vote.
The European politicians say they hope Poroshenko can launch talks to heal national divisions and to resolve the insurgency in the east. But dialogue may be all the harder after separatists seized Donetsk airport Sunday night, prompting an airstrike Monday by the Ukrainian military. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Top military official in Nigeria says they know where more than 200 schoolgirls are being held captive by Islamist militants. Chief of Defense Staff Air Marshal Alex Bada spoke to reporters in Abuja.
The good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
He said a military operation could be dangerous for the girls. Bada added, we can't kill our girls in the name of trying to get them back. The schoolgirls were kidnapped in mid-April while taking exams at a secondary school in the remote northern village of Chibok. Militants from the Islamist group Boko Haram claim responsibility for those kidnappings. And Cameroon and Chad now sending thousands of troops to their border with Nigeria to fight Boko Haram. The troops were deployed shortly after leaders from the two countries met in Yaoundé and declared war against the violent group. Moki Edwin Kinzika has details.
These are soldiers of Cameroon's Rapid Intervention Battalion singing in excitement as they leave Yaoundé, capital of the West African country, for the border with Nigeria. They headed out barely a day after Presidents Idriss Déby of Chad and Paul Biya of Cameroon announced they are waging war on Boko Haram. Colonel Didier Bajek, spokesperson of the Cameroon military, told VOA that the soldiers will work with the local people to find out who members of the violent group are, since the soldiers are aware they will be fighting an enemy that uses unconventional tactics.
We have occupied the field so that the response should be more spontaneous. I want to say that we need a total cooperation from the public. This will encourage us in the field to know exactly that people are thinking about us and are supporting their defense forces. We especially await information from the population.
Before the soldiers left, Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Bengo, met with Chad's minister of national defense, Benindo Tatola, in Yaoundé. Ngo said Chad had also deployed troops to work together with Cameroonian forces on the borders with Nigeria. He also said troops from the two countries will cross into Nigeria and fight Boko Haram in collaboration with Nigerian forces. Nigeria has often accused Cameroon of not doing enough to fight Boko Haram, even though the terrorist group frequently crosses into Cameroonian territory. Cameroon has been attacked several times by Boko Haram. Earlier this month, rebels from the violent group attacked a military post in Kuseri, far north Cameroon, and freed one of their members being held there. They also attacked the locality of Waza in north Cameroon and stole 12 vehicles, kidnapped 10 Chinese workers, and killed a Cameroonian soldier. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
On Monday, Oscar Pistorius arrived at a psychiatric hospital in South Africa to begin the period of mental evaluation he was ordered to undergo by a judge at his murder trial. The judge ordered that Pistorius be observed by a panel of mental health experts for up to 30 days after a psychiatrist testified at his trial that he had anxiety disorder and it could have contributed to his fatal shooting of his girlfriend in 2013. Pistorius has testified that he mistook Reva Steenkamp for an intruder at his Pretoria home when he opened fire on her. Prosecutors contend Pistorius murdered Steenkamp after they had a heated argument.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Pope Francis ended his trip to the Middle East Monday with a series of meetings with religious and political leaders in Israel. VOA's Scott Bob reports.
Pope Francis, on the final day of his three-day trip to the Middle East, prayed and laid a wreath at Jerusalem's Yad Vashem Museum that commemorates the 6 million Jews killed during the Holocaust. He also placed a wreath on the grave of the father of modern Israel, Theodor Herzl, and he met with the two chief rabbis of Jerusalem. Earlier, the Pope met with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Sheikh Mohammed Hussein, at the Haram el-Sharif.
Cari fratelli, cari amici.
He said, "Dear friends, from this holy place, I make a heartfelt plea to all people and communities who look to Abraham. May we respect and love one another as brothers and sisters," he said. Scott Bob, Jerusalem.
Egyptians vote for a second day today, casting ballots for new president. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo on Monday's voting.
Those taking part in Egypt's election for a new president were in a largely festive mood Monday, cheering on their country and the man widely expected to win the race, former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Voters expressed optimism the process would go well.
So that Egypt lives in a new era of democracy and freedom and solidarity for all the forces of the Egyptian people.
Sisi himself voted early, saying Egyptians were coming out to write their history.
The turnout, God willing, will be beautiful and great, God willing. Long live Egypt.
The man who last year helped oust Egypt's first freely elected president, Mohamed Morsi, is seeking a mandate, much like the one he used to crack down on Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood. But the campaign against the Brotherhood, as well as subsequent bans on pro-democracy forces, has gained Sisi enemies and led many to boycott the vote. Heavy security highlights the continuing tensions. Some voters showed little sympathy for the disenfranchised.
They have certain rules, not to follow this or that, not to do this or that. This will be good for them, and then they can have their freedom.
Such an atmosphere is compounded by Sisi's near total backing by Egyptian media and a muted campaign from his sole competitor, Hamdine Sabahi, prompting questions about the overall fairness of the election. But foreign observers Monday said the voting itself appeared to be proceeding smoothly.
There was a bit of delay at the entrance, but I think so far so good.
Polls closed Tuesday evening with few surprises expected in the results. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Jordan has expelled Syria's ambassador, prompting Damascus to retaliate by barring Jordan's top diplomat in Syria. Spokesperson for Jordan's foreign ministry said Monday the Syrian diplomat used his platform in Jordan to level what she called unfounded accusations against the kingdom and its allies. In some of his social media postings, the ambassador criticized Jordan for accepting a U.S. missile battery to counter the threat posed by the Syrian civil war. He also accused Jordan of providing a safe haven for Syrian army defectors. The U.N. Refugee Agency says hundreds of refugees in Jordan and Syria are being denied cancer treatment because of a lack of funds. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the number of refugees with cancer is overwhelming health systems in Jordan and Syria. UNHCR's top medical expert, Paul Spiegel, tells VOA decisions on who gets treatment and who does not are made on the basis of cost. He says helping the largest number of people with the limited amount of money on hand is usually the determining factor.
For the colleagues themselves that have to deal with this, it is extremely, extremely difficult, and we sometimes try to help them, to give them counseling. We have a standard operating procedure that can be shared with both the doctors and the refugees to say, this is what happens, and we do this in order to help the most amount of people, but no matter which way you look at it, it's a horrible experience.
A new UNHCR study tracks refugee cancer cases in Jordan and Syria from 2009 to 2012. It says the number of cases in the region is rising because there are more refugees and more people fleeing middle-income countries such as Syria. The UNHCR has set up an exceptional care committee which decides whether to fund expensive treatments. The study finds the most common form of cancer among refugees is breast cancer, accounting for almost one quarter of all applications in Jordan. Of 511 cancer cases, Dr. Spiegel says fewer than half were approved for treatment between 2010 and 2012. He says treatment is usually denied to patients with little chance of recovery.
So that the treatment would not actually prolong the life or prolong for a very short period of time, 6 months, and would be very expensive to someone like this would be denied. Because, again, I know it sounds heartless and it's a very difficult decision, but with a limited amount of money, we can ensure that we can treat people where we can hopefully cure the cancer, or at least what's called a functional cure, so that they will have at least five more years and hopefully a lifetime.
Dr. Spiegel notes many hospitals in Syria have been destroyed or closed by conflict. He says it is likely many Syrians with serious health problems choose to leave the country more in hopes of getting treated for their illnesses than out of security concerns. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
President Obama has paid tribute to America's war dead as the United States marked the annual Memorial Day commemoration. VOA's Michael Bowman has our report.
Hours after completing a whirlwind trip to visit U.S. troops in Afghanistan, President Barack Obama laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery just across the Potomac River from Washington. Moments later, Mr. Obama noted the ultimate sacrifices made by generations of Americans from the nation's founding to the present day.
Everything that we hold precious in this country was made possible by Americans who gave their all. And because of them, our nation is stronger, safer, and will always remain a shining beacon of freedom for the rest of the world.
The president paid special tribute to the widow of a soldier who went missing during the Korean War and who waited more than 60 years for her husband's remains to be found and returned for burial in the United States. Mr. Obama noted that 2014 marks the final year of combat for American forces in Afghanistan and the 150th anniversary of the founding of Arlington National Cemetery. Next month marks 70 years since U.S. troops stormed the beaches at Normandy, France during World War II. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Here in the U.S., controversial National Basketball Association team owner Donald Sterling has a day in court later today to respond to the league's charge that he damaged the NBA. Sterling's racist comments already have led to a lifetime ban from the game and a $2.5 million fine. VOA's David Byrd reports the case is far from over and could drag the league and other team owners into a public fight nobody wants.
News reports say that Donald Sterling has transferred his ownership stake in the Los Angeles Clippers to his estranged wife, Shelley. The reports, by sources not authorized to comment on the negotiations, said that Shelley Sterling is negotiating the sale of the team but wants to retain a minority interest. That creates a complicated mix for the NBA. Commissioner Adam Silver has banned Donald Sterling for life after his recorded racist rant against African Americans, including former NBA star Magic Johnson, was posted on the Internet. Sterling has been accused of damaging the league and causing it to come into disrepute. So far, Sterling has refused to pay the $2.5 million fine, thus violating the NBA Constitution and the agreement he signed as a team owner. But a prolonged court fight could be bad for the league as well. Roshini Rajkumar is a licensed attorney and the author of Communicate That, Your Toolbox for Powerful Presence. She told VOA that the last thing the NBA wants is a drawn-out fight with the Sterlings.
This certainly does not help the NBA in any way. It reminds us, you know, every time one team gets a strike against it, reporters dig up all the other bad things that have happened in the NBA, so you're seeing those anecdotes come back to life from the past couple decades because of this Sterling controversy.
Technically, the Clippers are owned by the Sterling Family Trust in the names of Donald and Shelley Sterling, and Commissioner Silver said the league's actions are against Donald Sterling only. But players want both Sterlings to lose any control of the team. Star Miami Heat player LeBron James said the sooner the Sterlings are gone, the better.
I mean, it's very important. We don't want this lingering around our sport. I mean, it sucks that it happened, but, you know, as players, owners, and everyone associated with this game, there's no need for it. So, you know, the quicker it get done, the quicker we can move on.
But moving on might not be as simple as getting rid of Donald Sterling. Last week, controversial Dallas Mavericks team owner Mark Cuban told Inc. magazine that if he saw a black kid in a hoodie and it's late at night, I'm walking to the other side of the street. Cuban said he would also avoid what he called a bald white guy with tattoos on the street. Cuban has not said how he will vote in Sterling's case, but many observers defended his comments because the Mavericks owner said that to charge someone else with racism while harboring racist thoughts makes him a hypocrite. Roshini Rajkumar says a prolonged court fight with Donald Sterling would not be good for the league's image.
I don't know that a lot of owners are going to want to open themselves up to the depositions that could follow if they decide to forcibly oust him, and then his legal team might come back at them and fully open up the lids of every other team and other possible racial behavior or misdeeds of the other owners.
LeBron James says that players are hoping the situation is resolved quickly.
I mean, we all hoped that it would go fast, but we also know the judicial system too as well. And you know, litigations can go on for time and time and time, so you have to be patient with that. But, you know, we're all optimistic that it can go fast.
Donald Sterling has to respond to the NBA's charges by Tuesday. He also has the right to appear at a June 3rd hearing and to make a presentation to the league before it votes whether to terminate his ownership. A three-quarters vote of the league owners is needed to strip Donald Sterling of the Clippers team. The NBA says the same is true if Shelley Sterling owns the Clippers. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And in football news, Nigeria has undergone a significant transformation over the last two seasons, winning their first Africa Cup of Nations title last year. Coach Stephen Keshi has sought to lower the average age of his squad, and despite controversy frequently surrounding his selection policy, his methods have been largely successful. Nosa Igibor is a midfielder for the Nigerian Super Eagles.
I think, you know, now in Nigeria, they want to raise like a new team with young boys. The guys in 2002 and 1994, those were older guys. But now even in Nigerians, they want to like raise football from the grassroots, and it's like younger players in the national team. In the national team back then, you can't get a player of 20 years old, 19 years old, but now we have it. So it's like from the grassroots, and that's the most important thing of all.
This year will be a fifth World Cup appearance for Nigeria, and Igibor believes that their status as African champion should give his teammates plenty of confidence heading to Brazil.
We're going to the World Cup to really prove to people, you understand, that we got the boys, and I'm hoping and I'm praying that we get to the semifinals.
Nigeria will open their World Cup play against Iran on June 16th in Brazil before facing Bosnia-Herzegovina and Argentina on the 21st and 25th of June, respectively. One last story for you. Former Beatle Paul McCartney has recovered from a virus that forced the cancellation of his Asian tour. Early today, McCartney was well enough to leave Tokyo by airplane, according to the organizer of the Japanese leg of his global tour, songwriter, singer, arrived in Japan on May 15th and was due to play four sold-out dates in Tokyo and Osaka, but the 71-year-old pop veteran canceled all performances as well as those in South Korea after getting sick from an undisclosed virus. World Tour is expected to resume in the U.S. next month with sold-out venues in the Texas cities of Lubbock and Dallas. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. And the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jesse Brooks, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On May 27, 1703, Russian Tsar Peter the Great, having recaptured land controlled by Sweden, ordered construction of a city on the site of a former Swedish fortress along the banks of the Neva River. That city would become St. Petersburg and for two centuries would serve as the Russian capital. In 1905, the Japanese fleet began a battle that destroyed Russia's East Sea Fleet in the Straits of Tsushima. It was the decisive battle of the Russo-Japanese War and marked the first time that radio transmissions played an important role in a naval engagement. It was also the first defeat of a European power by an Asian nation. On this day in 1941, the British Navy sank the German battleship, the Bismarck, in the North Atlantic near France. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill had ordered the sinking of the German ship after it had managed to sink the HMS Hood, the flagship and pride of the Royal Navy. More than 2,000 crew members were killed in the sinking of the Bismarck. And on this day in 1957, Brunswick Records released That'll Be the Day, a song that would become the first hit for Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
Buddy Holly died in a plane crash in Iowa when he was just 22 years old, but his body of work is considered among the most influential in rock music history. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a...
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Voters in Guinea-Bissau helped the West African nation take a large step toward returning to democratic rule, turning out in good numbers to choose former finance minister José Mário Vaz as president in the May 18th runoff election. In balloting seen by international monitors as transparent, credible, and without major incident, Mr. Vaz received 61.9% of the vote, defeating independent candidate Nunu Gomes Nabiam, who took 38.1%. The nation's Supreme Court must now validate the results before they become official. A decision is expected in the coming days. Mr. Vaz is the first freely elected president since a coup disrupted voting in 2012. A transitional government has ruled since the military surrendered power, and the new president taking office will end that transition back to elected rule. The United States congratulates the people of Guinea-Bissau and looks forward to working with Mr. Vaz and his government as it works to achieve lasting peace in the region. We also commend Mr. Nabiam for accepting the result and conceding for the sake of peace and stability. We urge the country's leaders, both civilian and military, to hear the voice of their people and bring the political transition period to a successful conclusion. These elections offer the opportunity for comprehensive reforms to break Guinea-Bissau's cycle of corruption and make progress on providing public services, advancing democracy, and expanding the country's development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.